Fort base had 10 satellites on board, and each one was weighed 2,000 pounds. It was a successful launch, got up to this, around that 400-mile altitude. But the booster was the first one that was saved on the west coast, and it landed on a barge. Drop it. And SpaceX brought that barge and eventually brought the rocket back to Texas. Yeah, you know, this is the first stage rocket. And they retested all the nine rockets again, the Merlin D rockets. That's what they call each one. It's called Merlin D. And they tested them all together. At a hold down launch facility in Texas. Everything worked out good. They sent it to Florida. Now it's waiting to be relaunched again with Bulgarian satellites to be put into geosynchronous orbit, because it's going into geosynchronous orbit. It goes further downrange. They use a lot more fuel to do that, and they won't have that much left to bring that booster back to Cape Canaveral. So, again, that's going to land on a booster about 400 east of Cape Canaveral. And if it lands successfully, they'll bring that back and maybe even launch it a third time. Bring it back to Texas, go through the whole thing again, relight the engines, and eventually put it on a launch pad again. And maybe by that time they'll have Launch Complex 40 operating. They expect that to be ready in a couple of months. And once they do that, you're going to see a lot of commercial flights being launched from that complex. And they'll probably reserve a lot of the future launches at Launch Complex 39A, which they're doing launches from now. They'll probably use the Falcon Heavy, which they haven't used yet, which is really three Falcon 9s launched at the same time. So that should be interesting. Probably this fall. With that, they'll take the Centum booster. That will probably go downrange and land on a barge. The other two will fly back to Cape Canaveral. That is, they put into operation this self-detecting mechanism on board the booster using GPS. So the booster knows where it is at all times. If it should go out of the path that it's normally supposed to travel, it would know that and it would detonate and destroy the booster. They have that for safety, just in case it goes to a populated area or goes where it's not supposed to go. It was first demonstrated on the last flight from Cape Canaveral and worked out very good. Let me drop it. And this time, they're going to do it again. They need to accomplish this because there's a lot more involved if you don't have to, you know, for the last 50 years they've been launching rockets and they have radar equipment on Merritt Island and different places. All kinds of people are employed to watch these rockets as they go off. And if they detect they're going off course with their radar equipment, they know that's no good and they'll detonate it. And this is all automatic. So they don't need these people. They don't need the equipment. And they'll be able to do two boosters, or in this case really three boosters at one time. They're independent of the booster sees that they're going off path. It'll detonate. If not, then both boosters will come back. back land back at Cape Canaveral. That landing zone, when they call it, used to be called Launch Complex 13. So you have one landed out on a barge, the other two will be able to land back and land. So that's a pretty good system. They've wanted to do this for quite a while. SpaceX is the first one to succeed in doing it. So now they don't need all this equipment. As it was very hard for them, let's say, launch one rocket one day, and then the next day another rocket, but you know, you can buy another company. Because all these radar equipment at Merritt Island and places would have to be all reset, and everything changed around. They always required a certain amount of time, you know, in between launches. Now that's not going to be necessary. So I thought that was pretty interesting that they're going to do this. That spaceport is really turning into a multi-port place. You have private companies, you have government launching out of there, and many different companies, especially in the near future. And same thing for Vandenberg. You have the quite a few launches going out of Vandenberg. You still have Delta Force that are able to be launched out of there, as well as SpaceX, the WS2M. And in other space news, last week they had a Progress ship go up and launch from Kazakhstan on a Soyuz launch vehicle, and that is successfully docked with the Zvezda Russian module, the aft end. And they'll be able to open up the door now and go inside, go through the hatch, and bring in a couple of thousand, up to 5,000 pounds worth of stuff. It includes food, equipment, some repair equipment that the Russians need. It also has two big tanks on board, one with oxygen and one with fuel, that automatically attaches to the space station and puts fuel into the module. You know, they use that to keep the space station in orbit. They're able to, that thing has rockets on it. So that always constantly needs refueling. That's one of the jobs that the Progress ship does. They have a couple of lines on the outside of the Progress ship that automatically connect to the space station, and they were able to refuel. They can do that from a couple of different ports. They drop it. It was scheduled a couple of years ago to have this particular Progress vehicle, after it finished its job in the port that it docked with, it was going to detach from the space station and then redock with the Pier's docking port. Pier's docking port is another small module that the Russians have, and their plan was to disconnect Pier's. It would have been the first module of the space station to actually be disconnected, and they were going to deorbit it using that Progress cargo ship at the end of its term. But and then we're going to burn it up over the Pacific Ocean. The reason for it was they planned on bringing up another large module, a multi-purpose logistics module that the Russians have built, but it's long been delayed. It's like over 10 years now. And again, it's being delayed, and they think they might have that available at the end of the end of 2018. So a couple of Progress missions from now, it's now scheduled to do that. But that gives you an idea of how long that space station has been up there. They're already starting to think about getting rid of one module and replacing it with another large, very large module. The Russian big science module that they plan on putting up there. so many years ago. And it has an extra bathroom in there, and it's very well equipped. Let me drop it. And that's pretty much it. I know last week we were talking about the sounding rocket that was supposed to be taking off from Wallops Island. And time and time again, all week long, they tried to get that thing up. But, you know, one thing is delayed after another. One time it was upper level, cloudy, and so on and so forth. So they were given up to the 18th. And so to do this, they started back in the end of May. But because they've had so many problems, they've had eight different delays now on this rocket. This is the one that's supposed to go up at around 120 some odd miles. It's going to release these canisters with these different color clouds that would have came out red, green, blue. And you'd be able to, on a clear night, you'd be able to see it. They said from New York all the way down to South Carolina. Let me drop it. This Terrier rocket is about, I think it's about, I don't know, 40 feet long or something, and it's not very big. I think it's only roughly 2 feet in diameter, something like that. But it's suborbital. NASA now has a go for an extended, I think, tomorrow, and the day after, and then they have to skip a day, and then I think a couple of days after that. So, you know, sometime maybe during this week, if they can get a clear night, and if everything goes well, they can finally get this rocket off the ground. So, that's pretty much it for now. There's other things. We'll let that go for now. K2RIW, this is WS2N for the space portion of the segment.
Paul, the sounding rocket that's going to release red, green, and blue chemistry into the air. Are they using three different colors of chemistry because they're going to release them at three different altitudes? And therefore they want to watch the which direction the air currents are moving at those altitudes. Is that the part of this experiment? Is that part of the motivation of this experiment, Paul? Over to you, K2RIW.
Yeah, they want to watch the cloud, you know, it's developed at different altitudes. So I guess blue will be at one altitude, you know, red and then green. And each can is supposed to be only the size of a Coke can, so whatever this is, barium or whatever it is, the chemicals they're releasing. I guess I can go to their website and find out exactly the chemicals, but whatever it is, they'll know the altitude that it's at. And they have different people viewing it. One group is at Duck Island up north, another one down south. They're going to monitor the cloud, I guess. See how fast it moves, which direction it moves. You know, they have probably all sorts of equipment looking at this, I would imagine. And they want to study the ionosphere. It's relatively easy to study what goes on in space because you have at 250 miles an hour, we have a space station up there, the International Space Station. Down at the lower altitudes, they have balloons. They launch on a regular basis, especially down in Antarctica or sometimes up north, Greenland. And they'll launch these balloons and they can study the lower parts of the atmosphere. But that ionosphere, that, you know, that in between, just slightly below where the, you know, where you can monitor things with the space station or even with a satellite. Because it's too low, you know, it's in space once you get up to 100 kilometers. But anything above that, you consider it in space. But you're not going to last long at 101 kilometers. You know, you're going to have to, you're going to slow down. It's rarefied air, and eventually you're going to start to deorbit. So it's a tough area to monitor on a regular basis. That's one of the main purposes of these sounding rockets. They penetrate those areas. They do a lot of science with these things. And they've been doing it for years, you know, they've decades. They use the sounding rockets practically.
Yeah, they do give some pretty good information from time to time. Anybody within the sound of our voice has some further questions on the subject of space launches, give me your call letters right now. And call letter the name, K2RIWM in the tech net.
Be able to provide a little insight if it's something the group would like. I worked on the command and destruct system for launches out of Vandenberg and Patrick Air Force Base. This is KC2 SHO.
KC2 SHO. I should know your name, please tell me. And give us a little bit of information about what was like on that command and destruct information. In other words, I presume there's electronics on board where you can send a destruct signal, an RS signal, in order to break up the craft if it's in pieces of are about to come down over a populated area. You want to break it up into pieces so that you drastically limit its destructive capability. I am guessing that's the reason for the command and destruct. Is that true? KC2SHO, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, KC2SHO, this is John. I used to live in New Jersey now, out in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Need to get online and change that information, so I'm going to need for anyone to remind me. Yeah, that's correct. So the real short of it is there are two systems. Both are on highly directional, parabolic dishes. One is a full two-way telemetry system. They can destruct, command and destruct the system from the telemetry system. But if for some reason they should lose the ability to control or use that telemetry system to do what it's supposed to do, that the backup system is transmit only. So there is a 10 kilowatt CW system, highly directional again, with basically destruct only command. And I guess they can command it to some respect, but I think the major point of it is to, if they lose control of the thing, to tell it to destruct. So I worked on that RS system for the backup. It was quite interesting and quite educational. I don't know what else I could tell you, but would be glad to entertain any questions if you had some. K2RIW, KC2, SHO, Los Alamos, New Mexico.
Good information, John. If I was working on a system like that, the main thing I would worry about is whether or not a false alarm signal could affect the destruct system. The fact that you're using a 10 kilowatt transmitter, that means only something that's pretty potent. My guess is the receiver was intentionally made to be a well-filtered mixer front end with no preamplifier so that only strong signals would be affected. I'm guessing it's on a carefully selected frequency. There might be a PL tone involved, so you've got to have the right PL tone. And it's probably, the message itself is probably encoded in a certain way so that only a message that has the right power, the right frequency, the right PL tone, and the right encoding is capable of activating the destruct system. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, but if I was the designer of the system, I would like to have at least all of those safeguards involved just to make sure that it doesn't blow up at the wrong time. Are any of my guesses even close to John? KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Unfortunately, I don't have much information on how all that works, and I don't know that that would be wise to spread around anyway, but yes, I'm pretty sure that whether it's digitally encoded or if they send pulses in certain, you know, in certain ways or what they do, but right, they have certain frequencies that they use. It was a quite broadbanded thing, covering, let's see, it was like 300, 400 meg, if I remember right. But anyway, I don't know much about how all of the system itself works to make it destruct, but I was really only involved with the commissioning of the 10 kilowatt transmitter. I saw the dishes and their design down at Viasat in Atlanta, which, you know, is a, I think it's spun off of Scientific Atlanta, so it's right there nearby, maybe even on the same premises. So it's all the dishes being, you know, built, designed, the antenna itself being designed there. Very interesting stuff. Unfortunately, yeah, I can't comment too much on the real, you know, nuts and bolts of the destruct signal itself.
At 300 or 400 megacycles, to get a lot of gain, you need a pretty big dish. I'm guessing the dish was either 18 or 28 feet in diameter. You know, correct me on that one. And the 10 kilowatt transmitter, I'm wondering, was that a tube type transmitter, John? KC2SHO, B2RIW in the TechNet.
I was working for Itelco USA at the time, so it was a solid, well, Itelco did both solid state and tube equipment. You may know their equipment. Your TV broadcast professionals probably know that name. Although they've since changed and altered, the Itelco brand is still around, even though it's not the the main company anymore. Anyway, so we sent a solid-state 10-kilowatt CW transmitter. ITT was the contractor at the time. And, what else can I tell you about it? The dish is huge, yeah, humongous size. You're in the right range. I couldn't tell you exactly. I probably have some photos somewhere. If you were curious, I could send those along. Yeah, I don't know what else can I tell you. I think you may have asked more questions than I answered, but feel free to ask it again if I failed to respond. And it was a backfire helix with a parabolic reflector. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Sounds like the feed horn for the dish was a backfired helix. That's a little bit unusual. By backfire, let me think now. Does that mean the helix was aimed into a subreflector and then bouncing back into the dish? Or the helix was just aimed into the dish? You called it a backfired helix. Give me a few words on that one, John. KC2SHO. K2RIW.
Well, I'm no antenna designer, but I think I have some enough knowledge to at least understand it. But this helix was just sticking right out of the dish. So maybe the photos might really clarify it. This was a long time ago looking at this equipment, but that was the term they were using, that it was a backfire helix. And it was a helical antenna, basically, if I remember correctly, just sticking out of the center of the dish.
Many times a dish will have a tripod assembly where the legs start at the perimeter of the dish and move out to the focal point of the dish, and that's where you mount the feed horn. and maybe that's where the helical antenna was mounted. If the helical antenna was at the apex of the dish, down at the bottom of the dish, then it would have to be firing into a subreflector that's at the focal point. You can't light up a parabolic dish by putting a helix or a feed horn at the center of the dish, at the apex of the dish, at the bottom of the well, if you know what I mean. Your words are leading me to believe that's where the helix was mounted, and that wouldn't properly illuminate the RF energy into that dish. So, how far in front of the dish was the helix mounted to your memory, John? KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, and maybe my memory is not serving me correctly, so I'm going for my photos folders here, and I will actually look for that. But you might be right. Yeah, maybe it was not quite like I said. I'll find the photos, and that'll really clarify it. But, yeah, we're talking early 2000s. I've slipped a lot since then.
Yeah, there's, in my opinion, there's roughly 5,000 kinds of antennas. You'd be amazed how many different ways you can radiate a signal. And although there's a large number of antennas, to some degree, a significant percentage of them, somewhere in the bottom of the antenna, in the beginning of the feed line, so to speak, there was a dipole-like structure. A waveguide coax adapter really contains a probe in there that really is half a dipole. It's a monopole, and it's resonant. A Yagi obviously has a driven element that looks just like a dipole. But there's a dipole or a monopole as a subsection of a high percentage of the antenna. In the case of a helix, I'll admit the dipole-like structure is really a circular object. And there, it looks a little bit more like a traveling wave structure. The signal looks like it's propagating along the helix, starting at the bottom near the ground plane reflector of the helix. Although still, it looks like a traveling wave structure. It looks like the signal would be going down this spiral piece of wire. Once, in reality, the signal does bounce back and forth. There's a certain degree of standing wave structure in a helical antenna. John Krause appears to have been the inventor of the helix antenna in the 1948 time frame areas when he was doing that work at Ohio University. Let me drop that. There's an amazing number of ways you can make an antenna in a manner that's called a frequency selective surface, where no matter where you put a interruption in the sheet metal, a slot, an X-shaped object, a circular-shaped cut, or whatever, there's ways you can make it into an antenna. The joint between the fender and the body of an automobile, that joint, if you insulate it just right, can be made into an antenna. There are plainclothes vehicles that have got the side view mirror as the antenna, or the rear view speaker. The speaker near the rear window is an antenna. It can be a double ridge horn antenna. There's all kinds of ways you can hide an antenna on a car, and you'd never know the antenna is there. But hiding the helix right at the apex of the dish would be very hard to make that work well, in my opinion. The helix antenna tends to fire along the axis. There's a kind of helical-like antenna, a rubber duck antenna, for instance, does radiate broadside. But the majority of helical antennas radiate in an axial mode, and each turn of the helix is very close to one wavelength. Let me drop it. And there's a zillion designs for helical antennas. The biggest array of helix antennas that I've ever seen is the one that was being used by John Krause at Ohio University's radio telescope. He had a 96 helix phased array as his first radio telescope, in Miamisburg, Ohio, where he eventually built a great big reflective antenna called the Big Ear, which, by the way, over the last decade has been taken apart because the land underneath it got sold. And John Krause, WHAK, is now a silent key. Because part of the reason the land got sold is he was no longer alive to defend that whole beautiful radio telescope. And that's where they received the so-called WOW signal, W-O-W. Somebody wrote on it, on a strip shot recording, where an extremely potent signal was received one day, or about 20 or so years ago. And there's good reason to believe that that signal came from outside of the Earth. Anyway, with any further questions or comments on the subject of space or the subject of anything else we've discussed tonight, give me your call, letters, and name right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, I have a question.
Go right ahead, John.
I haven't seen much about this this up-and-coming movie that's playing through the summer about something like a meteor is going to crash into the Earth or an asteroid or something like that. In reality, if something is going that fast, like it has a speed of 100,000 miles an hour or faster, 150,000 miles, because this thing has been traveling for quite a while and quite a ways, how would you catch up with this thing to actually try to deflect it? Because I know you've mentioned before, like even a tiny deflection a long time ahead of where it's expected to do some damage would make the most amount of difference. But how would you catch something like that initially that's going that fast? Do we have, you know, rockets or something that can get propelled up to that kind of velocity to catch something like that in space and do something about it?
I believe, John, the answer is no. Various agencies are now creating radio telescope-like hardware, optical telescope-like hardware, looking for near-Earth objects, because we know there's a large number of objects out there that come close to intercepting the Earth at some time in their orbit. Now, some of these objects have got orbits that go on for hundreds of years per cycle, but still there's a lot of near-Earth objects out there. The Earth has been hit a large number of times over the 4.5 billion years that it's been here by asteroids, comets, and other pieces of space junk. But right now, it sure would be nice to say that we've got a defensive rocket sitting on the launch pad with a solid-state booster and a whole lot of power, ready to go and intercept something that we discover is going to hit the Earth at some time in the future. Sure, nice to say that we've got that ready to go. We do not. Right now, to my knowledge, very little funding has even been allocated toward looking for near-Earth objects. And I think an awful lot of that is being privately funded. Let me drop. As Paul can tell you, we've had at least two missions that I know of where we have intercepted a asteroid or a comet, something that has a rather nice, smooth orbit that doesn't come close to the Earth. But if something is suddenly discovered to be roaring out of the Kuiper Belt, this is that belt that's around our solar system, or the Oort cloud, this great big cloud that's way beyond that, if a piece of space junk suddenly discovered is roaring out of either one of those areas and is, so to speak, aimed straight for the Earth. Right now, we have no real defense for it, I believe. I'm going to turn it over to Paul for some further words on that. And I bet you there's been lots of proposals to build a defensive system. To my knowledge, essentially, none of it has gotten any funding. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, funding has been tough. There's been some funding, but for instance, Rusty Schweiker, he's the astronaut from Apollo 9 mission. And he's come up with a plan called the Sentinel. And he has this
It's all design. All he needs is money. And you put it into helio orbit, you know, around the sun. And, you know, on the inside of Earth's orbit. But looking out along the ecliptic plane. And it would be constantly taking pictures and looking for something that might be coming our way. You know, whatever we've detected now, you could, you know, you could multiply that by, you know, 100 times that amount easily with the Sentinel mission, and he can't get the funding. But the Congress is not working out. As far as the speed of a rocket, you would need years and years advance warning, but, you know, you don't have that. For instance, if something was coming around and you knew it was going to be coming close to the sun, popping out around the sun and then heading toward Earth, and you knew this maybe 10 years in advance, you could send a rocket like the one we're going to be sending. Called Parker. Parker satellite will be launched at the end of, I think it's August or September of next year. And that's going to be studying the sun. Well, that's going to get so close to the sun at its high speed, it'll be 450,000 miles per hour. So that's going to break all the records. The one that has close the record now, there was two sun satellites back in the 1970s called Helios. And that got up to around 150,000 miles an hour. But, you know, it takes so many years to plan. My guess is the surprise comet that, you know, you're talking about, Joe, might be coming out from behind the sun, and we're going to have, you know, maybe a couple of years to notice, or maybe less than that, maybe a year's notice. Like Dick says, we don't have anything ready to go, so that's going to be a problem. I had a question on the Helios, the antenna that they use for destructing the satellites. Let me drop it. I just wanted to go back to that for a minute. That John was talking about the satellite. You know, you've got a rocket going up, and then maybe it's going to go out of control, and you don't know which way it's facing, so you don't know the polarity of it. So maybe that's why they use that type of antenna deck, you know, this way, no matter which way it's facing, they're pretty much sure that they're going to get a good enough signal to destroy it instantaneously. I remember when SpaceX was testing the reusable rocket in Texas, they would launch this full-size Falcon 9 rocket, you know, the booster part of it, and they would launch it, and it would go up, you know, suborbital. And then it would come back down, and it would land right on the ground, exactly where, you know, where they would put an X on the ground, drop it. And it was a test booster. Call it the Falcon 9R for reusability. And then one day they sent it up, and it went out of control. You know, they're near Waco, Texas, or, you know, they're populated areas, you know, maybe 50 miles away, and they didn't want this thing going off course, so they just got destroyed in space. You know, I don't know if they had somebody with an antenna pointing at it to do that, or if it happened automatically, but, you know, I've never seen scenes of it going up, and all of a sudden, boom, completely destroyed. Wonder about the antenna, though, Dick. You know, wonder what they use. Do you think that's the reason they use that helico antenna? Back to you.
The 20 or 30 foot diameter dish that John probably saw as part of that destruct system is probably mounted on an azimuth elevation over azimuth pedestal so that it can track the spacecraft and aim its 30 dB gain antenna right at the spacecraft to make sure you get plenty of signal through it. The nice thing about a helical antenna is it radiates a circular polarized signal. So when you're radiating a circular polarized signal, the spacecraft itself can have almost any orientation and it's going to receive your signal. Whereas if you use linear polarization, if you set linear horizontal and the antenna on the satellite at this instant in time was vertical, cross polarization can give you a pretty deep no. It would be a very brief no, but it can be pretty deep. 20 or 30 dB of no is possible. With circular polarization, you never lose more than 3 dB. If a linear polarized antenna is being used, and 3 dB of sacrifice to make sure that you're always going to be able to talk to it is a good way to go. If the system is well designed, it probably has 20 or 30 decibels of fade margin. In other words, the signal strength that's being directed to the command and destruct receiver under normal circumstances is 20 or 30 dB above threshold. That's what I mean by fade margin. And the fact that you lose 3 dB of that because you're radiating a circular polarized signal into what may be a linear polarized antenna. The antenna on the spacecraft could very well be a patch antenna, a conformal antenna that lays flat to the sheet metal of the spacecraft. Let me drop it. That would be one way of putting an antenna on the spacecraft with very low aerodynamic drag and yet very robust for these patch antennas. There's a way of making an antenna that has, let me pick a number, a quarter of an inch of insulating material between the sheet metal of the spacecraft and the sheet metal of the antenna. There's a quarter inch or an eighth inch of dielectric material. And then if you properly excite that piece of sheet metal that is the patch antenna, even though it's somewhat wrapped around the cylindrical portion of the rocket, that still can be a very effective antenna. And maybe there's one of those on the north side and one of them on the south side, or maybe one every 120 degrees with a power summing system going into the receiver to make sure you've got complete coverage no matter how the spacecraft rotates. But the safest way to talk to something like that where you're not sure of the orientation is circular polarization. The Oscar satellite, let me drop it.
TJIS.
We'll go over to John in a minute. The Oscar satellite, in order to get full operation, the amateur ground stations were recommended to use circular polarization. So you could talk to the satellite no matter how it was oriented. K2JAS. K2L, I hear you. Go ahead, John. Wait a minute now. Is it John or Roger? I think it's Roger. Good. No, KC2. Yeah, that's Roger, I think. Go ahead, Roger.
K2JAS, and it is Roger. Thank you, Dick. Question. Is there planned, or is there in existence, a system by which we collect space garbage? Spent rockets that are still in orbit, and sundry pieces of metal or satellites or whatever that's not being used, and poses a hazard to navigation in Earth orbit. I guess that's about as simply as I can posit it. Back to you, Dick. This is Roger, K2JAS.
Yeah, darn good question, Roger, and I think the answer essentially is no. We have something like 5,000 pieces of space junk being tracked by NORAD, North American Air Defense Command. And in theory, you look at all of their charts before you do a launch to make sure that the spacecraft that you're launching is not going to run into one of those because it can be very destructive. And have there been proposals to go out there and collect all that junk and get rid of it? Yes. And it's an extremely difficult problem. Each piece of junk has got its own orbital altitude, inclination of orbit, ellipticity of orbit. In order to up with each one of those pieces of space junk to collect it and then do something with it. You'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. You take, for instance, the space shuttle, which has got some really powerful engines on board. If you put the space shuttle in orbit and you wanted to collect a piece of junk that has a slightly different orbital inclination, it's got the exact same altitude as the space shuttle's orbit, but it's got a couple of degrees of different tilt to its orbit. It takes a huge amount of fuel to change the inclination of orbit of something that's already in orbit. If they burned up every bit of fuel they've got on board, they can make a tilt of orbit of 3-4 degrees in one direction or the other. So as you can see, all of these pieces of junk range. Some of them have got polar orbits, some of them got equatorial orbits, some of them got orbits way in between. High altitude, low altitude, high ellipticity, circular, and so on. They've all got their individual orbits. So to meet up with each one of those is extremely difficult. So we have to wait until, let me drop. Most of the time we have to wait until the atmospheric drag slowly brings these pieces down, and that's happening very slowly. By the way, when it comes to near-Earth objects, that near-Earth object that hit the Soviet Union in the last couple of years, it created a whole lot of window destruction, broke a whole lot of windows, made a great big shockwave. That piece of near-Earth object had never been seen before it hit us. I think the best guess is that it came from the direction essentially behind the sun. We weren't looking in that direction. We didn't even know it was coming. And I think that piece of space junk was only a few meters in diameter. Can you imagine something that's a couple of miles in diameter moving at that kind of velocity, what it could do? Almost anything that hits the Earth from a long distance away, it's going to be moving at least 25,000 miles an hour. If you let go of something at a fairly long distance away and let it fall toward the Earth just because of Earth gravity, by the time it gets near the Earth, it's moving 25,000 miles an hour. For instance, let me drop. Each of the Apollo spacecraft that went to the moon, when they came back from the moon and entered the Earth's atmosphere, just that downhill ride from moon toward Earth made the pickup of speed of roughly 25,000 miles an hour. You only have to be 17,000 miles an hour, 17,500, to be in orbit around the Earth. But falling down that gravity well of Earth made it move 25,000 miles an hour. That piece of space junk that hit the Soviet Union, I'll bet you it was moving 40 or 50,000 miles an hour. And I'm pretty sure it was only a few meters in diameter, and I think the best guess is it came from roughly behind the sun, therefore it had never been seen. I bet you you've got a lot more information on this one, Paul. So tell us about that piece of junk that hit the Soviet Union a couple of years ago. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, and it was a Russian satellite that crashed in Canada decades ago. That caused quite a concern. Had some kind of plutonium system on board. Had a clean up in Canada. You never know. That was probably in the 1970s. But they do have a satellite that was supposed to go up and attach, well, it was kind of brought on board the International Space Station and then launched from the space station. It was called the Remove Debris Satellite, built by the ESA, the European Space Agency. It's only a $17 million funded experimental project. And it would be the largest satellite ever to be launched from the space station. What their plan was to do was, you know, this remove debris satellite was going to, after releasing it from the space station, you know, from the Japanese module, they have an airlock there, so they would release that with the
with the Japanese robotic arm, and it was above flying away from the space station. Being a demonstration model, it had a harpoon on board and a net, and so it was going to release its own small satellite, you know, maybe as big as a CubeSat, and the harpoon is going to be flying out with a net, so, you know, it's going to be able to snare it. Let me drop it.
Yeah, but after you snare it, what do you do next, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, because it's a test mission, they...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You know, it would come automatically right back to the satellite. But if it was truly going to deorbit, they wouldn't care. And then they would open up this solar wind type of, I don't know how many meters square thing's going to open up, and it's going to catch the rarefied air and eventually slow itself down and with deorbit. So the theory is you would take these things, dozens of them and thousands of them, I guess, and send them out and start collecting garbage, and then open up this big solar sail to actually face it toward ways the direction you're going, pick up the rarefied air, and it would start to slow itself down, and then start to deorbit. But this thing was built, but then NASA said, let's wait on this, let's look into it further. It's a very large thing that they want to bring up on SpaceX Dragon. Let me drop it. So last I heard, this European Space Agency removed debris spacecraft is now going to get a ride on the CR-13 or 14, probably at the end of, very end of this year, or probably most likely next year, 2018. And they'll test it out there, you know, at that time. But they need to get, you know, a little bit more information about it before they allow it to be brought on board the space station for a release from the Japanese module. 5-6.
Yeah, collecting space junk and doing something with it, very, very difficult. The only place where we clean up our own garbage to a degree is on the geosynchronous satellites. Because a geosynchronous satellite is in one-dimensional piece of real estate. It's got to be directly above the equator at a very specific altitude in a perfectly circular orbit at a particular longitude. That's your address. And you've got to stay within a 1 kilometer cube of that address or you start paying a fine to the Intelsat people. And when each one of those geosynchronous satellites get low on their positioning fuel, they use the last little bit of fuel they've got to blast the satellite into a higher orbit. The graveyard is up. Because anything in higher orbit than geosynchronous orbit slowly spirals outward in time. Anything in a lower orbit than geosynchronous slowly spirals inward. But you have to wait thousands of years for it to happen. So the graveyard for our geosynchronous satellites, to get them out of the way of the next one that's going to be launched to that address, is to put them in the upper graveyard. So in that case, which is a very small percentage of the things we put up, that we do clean up our mess. But everything else, no. Now, was it an asteroid or was it a comet that hit the Soviet Union a couple of years ago? Let me drop it. We saw a whole lot of movies of people's dashboard cameras in their automobiles at sunrise as this thing came in, made a great big flash in the sky, created a great big sonic boom, blasted a whole lot of windows, created a whole lot of cut skin on people because of the windows being blasted. I think that thing was only a couple of meters in diameter. I think it hit the Earth at something like 25,000 miles an hour. At a grazing angle, almost parallel to the Earth. created an awful lot of damage, and I think we had no no forewarning that it was coming. Is that, I wonder, did they ever give that thing a specific name, Paul? I think they named it after the town where it is hit. WS2N, KQLIW.
Yeah, I'm not sure the town's name. It's a Russian name. I forgot the name of it. And there's been a lot of shows on that topic. And I thought it was coming in, and they thought they said miles per hour. And the size, I don't know what the estimate size was, but they saw it, you know, then they heard it, and there was a shockwave after that, and it really destroyed a lot of glass, knocked a lot of tiles down, ceiling tiles, people got hurt. So, that was a surprise. But to go back to what Joe was saying, to catch up to these things, yeah, we've only done it a few enough times. We're doing it now with Osiris Rex. They're going to go out to an asteroid, bring a piece of that back, and that's going to take quite a few years from now, but that's on its way. And then there was the Near spacecraft. The Near spacecraft orbited Eros, and eventually they decided to land it on Eros, and they still got signals coming back after they did it. It wasn't even designed to land on it. They just came down very slow, extremely slow, and then it landed. It, had solar wings on it. It's not even designed for it. They thought about it at the last minute, and that was very successful. And then they shut it down completely. And the European Space Agency last year had...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
One. I guess they this one was a comet.
The wind that was called Kangaska. Kangaska was that Russian thing that came in.
Spacecraft orbited this thing for over a year, and it went around the sun, came back out the other side of the sun, and now that thing has been decommissioned, and they decided to crash land that whole spacecraft or so on that comet. So, you know, we've had some experience with doing this, but and the different speeds, you know, whatever they're going at, successfully have done it. But if something comes around, and then what do you do with it? You know, you can't blow it up. Sometimes that'll make things worse. They're thinking about this. Painting the whole side of it, bringing out mylar and covering half of it, and with photons coming from the sun, it might change its direction. They got all these way out ideas, and but we got nothing, like you said. Back to you, Dick.
There's a thing that was called the Tunguska blast. That one was over Russia.
Yes, in 1908, there was a great big blast called the Tunguska event, which leveled the trees for a number of square miles, created the equivalent of a many megaton bomb. But the most recent one was February 15th, 2013. It's called the Chelyabinsk Meteor. That occurred at 9 o'clock in the morning. The thing was moving 19 kilometers per second. 42,000 miles an hour, and it was believed to be something like 20 meters in diameter. It created 1,400 non-fatal injuries, damaged thousands of buildings' windows. Let me think. Where was that section here?